Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I am doing well, and I am beyond thrilled to be joined by not one, but two fantastic guests today. We have both Elizabeth Kucinich and Dennis Kucinich joining us to talk about their pathway to becoming the leaders that they've become in the arena of creating the world we want to see. Both of them have remarkable backgrounds. Dennis Kucinich has been an environmental policy champion, serving our country in various political positions, including the House of Representatives, as Ohio State Senator, Mayor of Cleveland, a former presidential candidate. He's also an international spokesperson and is the co-founder and advisory board co-chairman of Global Environmental Media. And Elizabeth Kucinich is also working with GEM and the Global Environmental Media. She's on the board of directors for Rodale Institute, also for Groundswell International, has produced several documentaries, including Hot Water, which is about fracking, and GMO OMG, which is about the genetically modified organization. So we're thrilled to be talking to them today and to learn a little bit more about their path to becoming the influencers that they are. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to join you. Thank you.
So could you both tell us a little bit about how you came to be so engaged in creating the world you want to see?
Do you want to go first?
No,
Okay.
You got a longer history, all of them.
Okay, so my interest in the environment came from growing up in the inner city. One of the many places that we lived at was Finney Avenue, and Finney Avenue behind our backyard had two sets of railroad tracks. On the other side of the tracks was this magical area called the Gully with rocks that had been dynamited from, creating way for the railroads. But then trees grew up and bushes grew and all kinds of flowers. And it was absolutely extraordinary. It was a place to go and be alone and apart and be with nature and oneself. And so as a young person, I started to understand the connectivity between myself as a human being and the natural world. I absolutely loved being there in that area that was known as the Gully. It was a place of great magic. I wrote about it in the first edition of an autobiography I did a few years ago called Courage to Survive. But that was only part of my environmental awakening. Another part came through reading the English Romantic poets, who were so steeped in a connection to nature. Theirs was a love of nature. When we talk about Wordsworth and the genre of poets during that period. Yeah, people who really understood the importance of the natural world, and I became immersed in the nuances of the connection between nature and the heart, between nature and one's thinking. Now, I had other reasons to be concerned about the natural world because I had a horrible case of asthma when I was a child. And we had a lot of smoking going on in our house. That didn't help. But we also had steel mills where the pollution was not controlled. And you also had an electric utility that was pumping out coal, burning sulfur dioxide that comes from burning of coal. And that, to me, that the pollution from the sulfur dioxide was horrible. I mean, as a child, I could get that and I could immediately feel the effects. And so when I got
did you recognize that as a threat as a child, or was it just part of the world you were in and was sort of this,
no, I don't know no, what you would call I knew it. I said, you know, breathing this stuff in. And then with the sulfur dioxide in particular, when every time I smell it, I thought, oh my gosh, this is having an effect on me.
Wow.
And so at age 23, I was elected to the Cleveland City Council. One of the first things I became involved in was helping to shape the city's first air pollution code. And I was adamant about enforcing the air pollution code. I found out that large industries were polluting at night. They said, we're not polluting anymore, but they were polluting at night. You'd wake up in the morning, you find this particulate all over your car and your windows of your house. And
as an aside, I think Wheelabrator in Saugus is now doing that to the people in Chelsea, which is a community in Boston that is undergoing stuff at night. Although they come out in the morning and their car is covered with dust.
But that goes in windows. People breathe it in. There's no question that, you know, later on, as I got into the scientific side of it, you know, I learned about the connection between air pollution and cardiopulmonary health or illness. And so I became involved in the environment, which, you know, in Cleveland was not just the air quality, but also water quality. At one point, Cleveland became famous for its river being on fire, but a lot of efforts were made by a lot of people to try to clean up the Cuyahoga River, clean up Lake Erie. Lake Erie is part of the chain of Great Lakes with the largest supply of fresh water in the world. So, you know, I became involved in various efforts over the years on that. I got to Congress and immediately was involved in issues to try to protect the Clean Air Act, to stop sludge from being called organic, for example. And I moved into a position where, you know, I put the legislation forward to set the goal of 350 parts per million of atmospheric carbon. That was part of the 350 movement. I represented the United States at two conferences of parties or international conferences where I talked about the importance of a multilateral approach towards dealing with our environmental challenges. And when I ran for president in 2003, the campaign started. I brought forward this idea of a global green deal. It wasn't only my idea. I worked with Mikhail Gorbachev and Jerry Brown and others to lift that up, and, you know, met with Jerry Brown in Johannesburg, where we, you know, talked about what we could do to move things forward. So, yeah, I've been involved.
I have a question, though, and this rewinds to a consistency I've seen, is that oftentimes when people tell their stories, they hearken back to a childhood connection, right? So, and you have talked about the gully, and that is as sort of the touchstone, right? Do you think that as a society, we should be making more of an effort to put kids into that situation? So that, I mean, and is there something that the new TV channel is thinking about? I know there's a kids section, but it's like that bonding that happens when you're 8 years old lasts a long time, I think. Would you agree with that? And tell me what you think.
I was actually having this thought a couple days ago when Elizabeth and I had a chance to go out on a walk in our metro parks. And we took a diversion and we're walking around this golf course. Nobody was around. But there's a lot of beauty there. And I had that very thought about we need to find ways of reintroducing children from the inner city into the natural environment, because I'll tell you, the environment in today's inner cities, anything but natural.
Well, I would go one step farther and say every kid playing video games, right? No matter how affluent they are, they're sequestered in the basement playing Donkey Kong or something. They need to be encouraged back into the real world as well. So anyway.
I agree with that, and I appreciate you bringing that up, because that kind of reminds me of the urgency of bringing this idea forward again. Elizabeth, you were going to add something to that.
Well, the founding of GEM, Global Environmental Media, you know, Dennis and I are co-founders, but the person who came up with the idea originally, his name is Christian Moore, Roger Moore's son, and he has a number of children, and he's acutely aware of what information is or isn't available to his children, how difficult it is or isn't to find it, and how important it is to really be able to encourage children to create a relationship with nature. And I was very fortunate in my childhood, my story will go all the way back there as well, in that I was taught to, you know, you care for what you love. And you have to have a relationship with something in order to be able to love it. And so if you don't know what nature is and you haven't been able to make that connection with the living world outside of your home, then it's very difficult to be able to have that sort of intimate relationship with it, or her, as I call it. But my grandmother was an amazing inspiration to me, as was my mother, my maternal grandmother. We would go on walks through the woods. You know, she had a dog, and every day we would go for a walk. And she would always wear a mac with big pockets. And in those pockets were always plastic bags. And in those plastic bags, after we came out of the wood, depending on the season, were either seeds of some kind. So it could be chestnuts or acorns or other things. And if it were a different time of year, there would be, instead of the seeds, they would be leaf mold. So, you know, when the leaves break down and make this beautiful leaf litter. And she would then, after the woodland walk, she would go to some barren landscape. So in our area, which is just outside London, there was a number of roads that were built through. So around London, there's this big, we call it the biggest ring road in Europe. It just goes around London. It's a or biggest roundabout, we call it. And so there's lots of barren landscapes, no trees, no nothing. And there my grandmother would go in her little red mini Clubman with that. Doors that would open at the back, and she'd have a walking stick. I mean, she was a real grandma. She'd have a little walking stick, and she would press the walking stick down into the soil, drop in a seed, tread on it, and then 6 or 7 paces later, she would do the same. Now, to me, this is direct action. You know, see, there's a place with no life, and you bring life to it. In the summer times, the hot summer, her little mini Clubman, the doors would open at the back, and there she would be with all the plastic jugs of water, and there she would be watering her seedlings all the way down. And so she stewarded our entire community. All the lanes now have these big mature trees, and that's because my grandma planted them. And my mother, on the other hand, we grew up in a little cottage at the end of a lane. It was a farm labourer's cottage that my mum and dad found when they were 18 years old, and they loved it. It was totally ramshackled. It was derelict. The front door was nailed up. The back door was tied up with a piece of string, and the whole of the landscape was used as a, you know, as a waste dump. And my parents fell in love with it. It was in a field, and we could see 3 Norman churches, which is, for anyone who doesn't know, that's over 1,000 years old, from my bedroom window. Until they built the M25, that big road through. And then we had big banks of nothingness and a big road instead, a motorway in front of us. And my mum fought for many years to get trees planted on there, and we did. And we were able to, you know, change the landscape in that way. And that barren wilderness that was my mother's garden, she is now a healing and teaching sanctuary. And she has hundreds and hundreds of different plants there, and it's mature, beautiful gardens. And I remember as a child, we would go out into the garden every day, and, you know, the activity really was to walk around the garden. And she would lift up, you know, different hanging plants and under them see how many snails there were and what kind of variety there were and all the wiggly worms and all the creepy crawlies. And we would dress up the dogs with their bibs, and we had a Beatrix Potter life in that, you know, the natural world was part of our home, and we lived in fairyland, you know. And so that was the culture of my family, being able to bring that in. And she taught me to turn a negative thought into a positive action. So if I didn't like what I saw, we have this rule in our house as well, because you can get really morose when you know so much about politics and the way the world works. And I say to Dennis, you're allowed to talk about it if we're going to do something about it, but don't just talk about it, because I don't need to go there. If, you know. So we talk about a lot of things, and therefore we do a lot of things. But to turn a negative thought into a positive action. So at the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, there was a really big environmental push. You know, during my childhood, we learned about climate change. We learned about all of these different things, endangered species, pollution, and all those kinds of things. And I took that to heart. You know, I became a member of many different environmental organizations, animal welfare organizations, and became known at school. My nickname was the Jolly Green Giant, because I'm happy, I'm large, and I'm obviously environmentally oriented. And I was always that annoying child that went to school with a petition or with letters. And I would often be found not at school, but actually in Parliament lobbying. So when I was in my A-levels, 17 and 18, I would spend more time in Parliament than I would at school because I wanted to see things changed. And, you know, that to me is, you know, that's my background from childhood. And then I asked the question really in my mind of what's the thing? What's the thing that's driving destruction and what's the thing that's going to drive regeneration? I didn't think of the term regeneration at that point, but that was it. And, you know, I really wanted to dedicate my life to helping to bring abundance and to support life and help people to relate to the natural world and to love and to have that, you know, that whole thing. And not in a sort of hippy dippy way, there's no problem with that, but just in a real way of, you know, being able to be part of the planet that you live on. And
a pragmatic recognition that we all here, we all have to.
Yeah, but coming from this, the joy of the living world, and you know, I love spiders and I love worms, and if it rains, and I'm like, I'm that person, that I'm that congressional spouse in Washington D.C. that when it rains and all the worms come on the pavement, I am the one with a bit of paper, like moving them all back. I don't want to be trod on, you know. So you know, that's the thing. It's about loving where you are and being able to express your veneration for life. And you know, to me, this is the real life movement that we're in now. You know, life is under threat and life is beautiful, and it's our opportunity to really show our commitment to the living landscape. And so I could go on.
I have to say I'm really glad that we are audio right now, because I have like tears, right? I mean, like, from your grandmother's story about planting seeds to you pushing the earthworms off of the street, the sidewalk, which I'm with you. I always feel so bad for those earthworms. It's just really beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
That was just gorgeous description. So I really want to very much thank you both for taking the time to share that sort of, I think it matters. It really matters. I will put up, we'll put this up on a blog, but I don't think there are, maybe there are, there's an autobiography, Dennis, that you've written. We can put on as a link and to the show notes, but this has been so personal and beautiful that it probably will let it stand on its own. If people have their own stories about how they came to be climate activists, why they care about the issue, send it to us at the email podcast@massclimateaction.net. We'd love to hear your story. You can listen to this show on any of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please tell your friends about the show and ask them why they care about climate while you're at it. I want to thank our friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. I want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. Dennis and Elizabeth, thank you so much for sharing. That was a beautiful, beautiful show. Mariah, thank you so much for being here. And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again next week. Bye-bye.
Very cool.